Welcome to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. This Mother's Day weekend, the choices for entertainment are as varied as they are plentiful right here in the Triad, and today I'll do my darndest to keep you in the loop. To begin with, what could be more wholesome than a Mother's Day jazz brunch with complimentary poetry reading? Poet Rodney Holman and Delta Fine Arts has you covered. Then we're off to historic Bethabara Park and their 12th annual Highland Games, where they're throwing logs and axes. They're also throwing their first annual Scottish Fiddling Competition, and Winston-Salem Triad Scottish Fiddlers and Friends co-director Debbie Morris is here to tell us all about it. Time to relax next with a leisurely stroll through American landscapes of the Country Place era, going on at Rinalda House in Winston-Salem. Once we've caught our breath, it's time to indie rock with Janice 414 at the Flatiron in Greensboro. Guitarist-singers Chad Barnard and Shane Mauck join us live from Studio A next on Triad Arts Weekend. Delta Fine Arts program developer Rodney Holman is also a North Carolina Governor's School Foundation board member, U.S. State Department Franklin Fellow, Winston-Salem Centennial Committee member, and Golden Leaf Scholars Program Center for Creative Leadership coach. Oh, and Rodney's also a poet, author, and a singer-songwriter. You can hear him reading selections from his new book of poems on Sunday, May 13th, during the Delta Arts Center's annual Mother's Day Jazz Brunch, beginning at 12:30. A few years ago, Rod decided to set aside his novel manuscript and publish a collection of his old poems as well as new, yet-to-be-written ones. He was faced with that fearful question, would he be able to once again summon the muse? Thankfully for us, the answer was yes, and the result is The Universal Solvent, Poems by Rodney Holman. It's just been published by L. James Press.
I do look at them as messages from the soul, telling me what's going on with me at a deep level, in case I don't know that already. And I sort of like that function of the poems. You know, a poem like Autonomous Complex, How Do I Stop Yesterday? Even if you don't know what autonomous means, it sort of screams, this is a poem about some internal process. And the first line is something like, today, at long last, I finally decommissioned my indwelling evil twin. And every now and then you write something and you're like, hey, I kind of like that myself, you know. And the repetition in that first line, all those adverbial phrases that at long last, finally, you know, let you know this person is full of relief that something is finally over. And I think focusing on being a writer, focusing more internally, that's one thing poetry does for you. It gives you a good through line. It makes sure that you know yourself pretty well, and I think that's important. Whenever there's something crazy in the news, when a person shoots up their workplace or other bizarre behavior that we see, bizarre or entertaining behavior, I think poetry saves me from that.
That's interesting, that process of reaffirmation when you do get that poem out that is new and you reconnect with that sensation of accomplishment or whatever you would deem that. Maybe read us one an early something from that output, that most recent output that wound up in The Universal Solvent that provided that balm for you. This is sure. Rodney.
Well, here's a new one that sort of surprised me. It's called In the Land Before Time. Once upon a time, I was too young for judgment, guile, or woe. I wore Dracula's cape, and I had a friend named Tony, who wore a fireman's cap and held a toy soldier, whose arms he manipulated in the service of an ongoing narrative. The sun shone brightly, and we only knew contentment. Mama stood in the doorway looking outside to make sure that no one was bleeding or missing. I glanced back every now and then to make sure that no one was bruised or crying. Once upon a time, I lived in a land before time, before the ogres and the mood swings, before the sloughs of despond and the melancholy. This photograph must have been taken then.
I love that poem for a number of different reasons. The question that came on the first reading was, I understand your mother looking on, but why are you looking back?
The speaker in the poem is implying that, yes, a parent is going to keep their eye on their kids, especially when they're outside, especially nowadays, but the kid is also keeping a watchful eye out on the mother. And the implication is that she could be in danger too. And the implication is domestic violence. So he's making sure that nothing is happening to her too. So it's sort of like bookends in a way. And the way it just sort of mildly and is calmly delivered to the reader, it just makes it interesting. And it's another one of those moments where I go, oh, wow, look how that came out, you know.
Wow. You paint such a vivid image. and that time period and the playing with the toy soldier and where you are on the sidewalk, it taps into, I imagine, lots of minds. My own, my friend Edmund Douglas, Detroit, Michigan, 1968, and playing on a sidewalk. And his mom called him away right in the middle of the fun, and he was gone with no warning, right in the middle of the heights of this euphoria. But I just find it interesting how you've picked a moment that I think 9 out of 10 people can relate to.
Sure, and what you just said about that moment being gone and that disappearing act, that's kind of how I feel about those childhood days. There's such a rosy gauze in the memory and in your feelings about that. And it's sort of like a distant land that you can't quite get to. You have a memory of. And that's sort of the gist of it.
A Wash in Birdsong, I enjoyed. There's something about Birdsong that locks me into something greater, as it does if I go to the sea, for example, or if I go, I'm on a big river, a big body of water, or something like that. I don't know quite why that is, but you kind of touch on it in this poem.
Sure. I was sitting near Salem College one day, and there was just trees full of birds, and it was so loud and so dominant, and I just thought, wow, it's sort of transporting. It's like water that takes your boat away, and that's how I felt. And the other thing about that is, in this area, there is a bird. So far, I think it's a white-throated sparrow, but it's a doo-doo-doo. That's what its song is like. I hear it all the time.
That descending three-note scale. Yes.
And I've got to talk to an expert about it and see if I can even turn it into a melody for a song. But do you want me to read a Wash in Birdsong?
Okay. Yeah.
I am a wash in birdsong, tart, evocative, healing, an ambient cocoon, a sonic shower, a tonal universe, inspiring a poet's theory of everything, general, relative, wavical. A particle matters insofar as its specific song. That is to say, its signature, its note, its tune, its telltale amplitude. While spinning you this way and that, it signifies its place in the biosphere, its clef, its chair in the symphony, its place in the universe, my universe, intentional, good, ample. A place for well-versed poets and birds on the wing and song, resonating, informing, inviting, transforming. Your timpani calibrates my heart's vitality. Your cello tugs at me here like longing looks. Your bird song carries me in astral flight, where, in at one moment, all I hear is many hearts, ecstatic sound. And I do mean that as a poet's theory of everything, how to understand the universe and how it's a field of vibration, different vibrations, why mystics and Eastern people talk about vibration so much, and listening to the birds put me in mind of all that.
Well, your love of science comes to the fore, too, with amplitude, particles, and even, well, I mean, I think of music theory and treble clefs as being somewhat mathematic and scientific. Yeah, it's a neat combination, and somehow life reaffirming at the granular level.
Yeah, the science, I love how the science comes through. And I so often am using scientific terminology to describe emotional context. And I was noticing that about my poem, and I was saying, I guess science is a big part of my poetics. And then I discovered a Mexican poet named Coral Bracho, and she really does that. Hers is very geological. Mine is often astronomical. Hers is very geological. And her poetry has things like the mossy designs and your gravid this. And I read one of her poems in Spanish and English, and I felt like I was in a trance. And the trance did not resolve till I had written a tribute poem similar to hers called The Fount, which is eerie, creepy, good, you know. So poetry can do that, put you in a trance until something resolves itself and comes out.
My thanks to Delta Fine Arts program developer, author, poet, and singer Rodney Holman. His new book of poetry out on L. James Press is titled The Universal Solvent, and you can hear Rod reading selections during the annual Delta Arts Center's Mother's Day Jazz Brunch on Sunday, May 13th, beginning at 12:30. You'll find links to more information on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. You're listening to Triad Arts Weekend on 88.5 WFDD, your NPR News and Triad Arts station from Wake Forest University. I'm David Ford, and coming up next, how about a Mother's Day weekend trip to experience the sights, sounds, and smells of an ancient culture right here in our own backyard? The 12th annual Bethabara Highland Games are coming up this Mother's Day weekend all day on Saturday, May 12th. There'll be literally something for everyone with outstanding Celtic and Moravian games, Scottish dance, great food from Finnegan's Wake, and lots of wonderful music. This year, the Bethabara Highland Games are hosting their first Scottish Fiddle competition. It'll be judged by National Scottish Fiddle champion Jane McMorrin from East Tennessee State University. Jane will be offering a workshop from 11 to 12 just ahead of the competition that kicks off at 1. There'll be prizes for each level of the competition for the junior, novice, and open divisions. Here to break down all the fun and fiddling lingo are Winston-Salem Triad Scottish Fiddlers and Friends co-director Debbie Morris and Historic Bethabara Park's Ellen Kutcher.
Historic Bethabara Park celebrates culture all year. We celebrate the Moravian culture. But when the Moravians first came down in 1753, coming down the Great Wagon Road through the Shenandoah Valley into North Carolina, there were many Scotch-Irish immigrants living in Virginia and around in North Carolina. And we always say that the Bethabara Highland Games are a nod to the help of the Scotch-Irish in the early days of Bethabara, in the early days of the Moravian settlement.
What brought the Scotch-Irish to this region?
Land. When we think back to the 1700s, the New England coast and Pennsylvania, land was getting crowded. There were a lot of immigrants, and if you wanted to go out and be a pioneer and be able to secure a large piece of land, you had to travel. And they came down the Great Wagon Road. Now, of course, North Carolina was the back of the western frontier at that time because they weren't crossing over the mountains, but they were coming down the Shenandoah Valley, down through North Carolina, eventually to Augusta, Georgia, and then out west. We're celebrating the Scotch-Irish culture. At the same time, all our historic buildings are open, so we're showing people how the Moravians lived in the 18th century. So Bethabara is special among Highland Games because of that, because we have a historic site that we can share in addition to the games.
You've been many times, I'm sure.
Yes, I have.
What's the feeling like for you when you're there?
Well, it takes the music that I'm interested in and play the Scottish music and has a great place for it. Then we've always had a fiddle jam tent where people could come and play various instruments. And then you have wonderful live traditional type bands that would show off the instruments in a different way. So it's a great day.
And as a fiddler yourself, I mean, you kind of get a chance to touch stone with that tradition.
Absolutely, absolutely. It's such an old tradition, and keeping it alive, which is what is really special about it. It's a venue for it that you don't have unless we have something like the Bethabara Games.
You're swapping tunes with folks and sharing what you know. And
right, yeah. And you have people that come specifically for different parts of the Bethabara, be it clan events or athletics or the music. So it kind of inspires children who hear something different on a violin, and it inspires other musicians or people to get them out from under the bed and get them out of the closet.
The 12th annual Bethabara Highland Games will be, as they've always been, incredibly colorful, multicultural, something for everyone. Music, Highland amateur athletics. The games are incredible. You have these big participants throwing things that look like telephone poles. So you can go watch the game, see the competition. You can listen to all kinds of music throughout the day. You can see pipe and drum bands. And that is right alongside of our Moravian games, colonial games, where you roll the hoops and you walk on stilts and you play tug of war. So everything is happening throughout the park, and you can go from one to the other and you can actively participate. We have wonderful British and Celtic food. Finnegan's Wake is going to be serving lunch in the 1803 Herman Butner Distiller's House. So there's something for every sense.
And this year, something new coming to the games. And we're talking about the Scottish Fiddle Competition. And Debbie, these competitions, it seems like every time I meet a fiddler who's serious about their craft, they're playing these competitions. It's a big deal, isn't it?
It is a big deal, because not only do we have games that qualify you, you have to be qualified to go to nationals. And nationals are held every year also. This year they'll be at the Virginia Celtic Games in Williamsburg area. And they allow you then, if you really desire, to go to Scotland for the competition. So, you know, there's a procedure for competitions, just like there are certain tunes that you have to play in a certain order for a competition. So Scottish fiddle competition is a little bit different than just a playoff.
It's almost like figure skating, doing your forms first.
Right. Okay, so you do the air of the lament and you stop so the judge can make notes. Mm-hmm. And then you start a set of three. You do a march and then a strathspe and then a reel. Several things are key, the transitions from one to the other.
Which are performed?
Yeah, you've got to go from a march beat to a strathspe beat to a reel beat. You have to keep the style of the march, as you would think about the Highland bagpipers marching. It can be a quick march or it can be a slower march, but it has to stay in tempo then when you move into your strathspe.
Okay.
And then when you move into your reel, even though you will change how fast it goes, it's still the same tempo.
The same beat. You can
right.
do double time.
Right.
Or I think most people are familiar with marches, a reel, an upbeat, typically fast number. But the strathspe is a new dance form for many, I'm sure.
Well, it's because it was a unique type of style to come out of Scotland, out of the valley of the River Spey, S-P-E-Y. And it was a 4-4 time. And it was partially to be played with dances. And there are about six varieties of types of strathspe dancing. So there's a Scottish bouncy, there's a strong strathspe, there's a strong or air strathspe. So there's varieties within it.
What is it about this music that moves you?
It just moves me inside in my heart. It's music that, if played well, can make you cry. And then lively, it makes you want to get up on your feet. There's a strongness about it, too. And I think, you know, the basis for that, that when I first heard it, I just felt like I've been looking for that all my life.
Soon you'll in California be.
My thanks to Winston-Salem Triad Scottish Fiddlers and Friends co-director Debbie Morris and Historic Bethabara Park's Ellen Kutcher. We've just been listening to National Scottish Fiddle Champion Jane McMorrin from East Tennessee State University. Jane will be judging Bethabara's first-ever Scottish Fiddle Competition at this year's Highland Games. The games are an all-day event, and the fiddling competition begins at 1 o'clock on Saturday, May 12th. You'll find links to more information at wfdd.org/triadarts. This is Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. We're going to take a short break right now, and when we get back, our Mother's Day tour will visit another of Winston-Salem's Triad treasures, Rinalda House and American Landscapes of the Country Place era. All will be revealed by American Landscape History Director Robin Carson next, when Triad Arts Weekend continues. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. A Genius for Place, American Landscapes of the Country Place Era. That's the current exhibit going on at Rinalda House Museum of American Art, where it'll remain through August 5th. American landscape design was shaped early on in the 19th century by Jackson Downing and Frederick Law Olmsted. Olmsted's last great project was a laying out of George Vanderbilt's 120,000-acre Biltmore Estate near Asheville. A Genius for Place is also the title of a new book by Library of American Landscape History Director Robin Carson. On Tuesday, May 15th at 5:30, she'll present an illustrated talk about several artistically expressive landscapes from this period, a period in which Rinalda House itself sits as a prime example. A Genius for Place, American Landscapes of the Country Place Era, published by University of Massachusetts Press, will be available for purchase and book signing by the author, and you'll find links to more information at wfdd.org/triadarts. In the meantime, here's a conversation I had with Robin last week. She spoke with me by phone from her office in Amherst, Massachusetts.
A lot of people have a connection to this art form, but many people think of it largely in terms of plants. In fact, on the broader scale, it also involves roads. It can involve changing the course of rivers. It can involve buildings, sculpture, and planting of trees, realignment of paths. Landscape architects pay attention to all kinds of forces in nature, not just plants, such as the trajectory of the sun, the play of shadows across a lawn, even the sound of a brook in a park.
Hearing you talk about that, Robin, just puts me in the mindset of like a really fine waiter, and that you know if they're doing their job correctly, you're really enjoying yourself or feeling something, and yet you're just not aware they're there. You're in a place and time in a location, and if it's landscaped well or designed well, it really does enrich your experience.
I think that's absolutely true, and a great example of that, and one that many people know, is Central Park, which has become a mecca for people all over the world because the experience of being in that place is so enriching. And in fact, most people, without thinking about it, assume that what was there? It's the part of the city that didn't get built up. They don't realize what a work of artifice it is, how Olmsted carried in or had carried in tons and tons of rock to build those outcroppings in the Ramble. He drained the swamps, dug lakes, created a very imaginative road system in order to sink the transit roads that run from one side of the city to the other down below grade so you wouldn't be aware of the traffic sounds. Many, many innovations like that, and much of the landscape architecture in this country, and this is one of the themes in my book and in the exhibition at Rinalda House, much of the landscape architecture of this country derives its force and its spirit from Olmsted's ideas.
You're talking about Frederick Law Olmsted, and I'm wondering if you could put him in perspective. I'm struck by the appreciation then versus now for this sort of art and thinking that Frederick Law Olmsted was really a rock star of sorts in his day. Could you put him in perspective? I mean, he was a giant.
He was a giant, and it would take several radio programs to do him justice. His contribution to the new art of landscape architecture, and he was the first person to identify himself that way, is enormous. He really did found the modern profession by establishing a very important office. It changed over years. It had different partners, including his son and his stepson. He ran it by diversifying the work within the office, by hiring specialists in different aspects of the art to coordinate and execute those aspects, from planting, for example, to engineering, but all combined to create a singular vision. His other great philosophical contribution was to teach others to pay attention to the spirit of the place, to respond to the cues that were there. Some of those are tangible, like a lake or a marsh or a beautiful view, and some of them are intangible. It's just a sense, a spirit, but to let that spirit guide the design so that it's not warring with the underlying sense of place that gives each place its distinction and its charm.
I can't remember the title of the book. Was it The Devil in the White City?
That was yes.
Yeah,
yes.
That book on so many levels gripped me, but much of it was the description of, well, first off, the undertaking of converting that Chicago Lakeshore area into this beautiful city, but also that impact. And that really did go on to influence a whole generation of the wealthy, the elite in this country in terms of their approach to developing landscapes. Did that spill into then your recent look at a country place era? Could you trace that for us?
There is a connection. The World's Columbian Exposition of 1893 was a turning point in American consciousness. This country saw itself for the first time as really playing on a world stage, economically, culturally, and artistically. 22 million people visited Chicago over the course of those 2 years, and they came away with a sense of what was possible. And those ideas transformed cities across the nation, new cities, young cities, and even old cities. It also transformed the sense of what could be done on a private estate. And, of course, that was a time of enormous wealth, especially before 1913, when income tax was implemented. People saw great potential in these pieces of property they were buying, mainly outside city hubs. And they saw that there was a new profession training people to create the same kind of magic that they saw in Chicago. Some of this magic derived from combining many different cultural influences, almost like a around the world in 80 days kind of feeling, you know, a bit of England here and France there and a touch of the East. And of course, people were traveling more to bring home memories from these wonderful grand tours they were taking, real citations from gardens. And sometimes adaptations of things they'd seen abroad, literally in their own backyards.
My thanks to Library of American Landscape History director and author Robin Carson. Her new book is titled A Genius for Place, American Landscapes of the Country Place Era, published by University of Massachusetts Press. Coming up May 15th at 5:30, Robin will be speaking about her work at a remarkable landscape of the country era that may just be familiar to you, Rinalda House Museum of American Art. She'll present other fine examples of original, expressive landscapes from that period, and there'll be a Q&A, book signings, and more. In the meantime, you can hear my complete interview with Robin Carson on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts, where you'll also find ticket information and more. You're listening to Triad Arts Weekend on 88.5 WFDD. I'm David Ford, and when we come back from this little intermission, it's time to rock, indie style, with Janice 414. The Mount Airy Band has just emerged from Mitch Easter's Fidelatorium Studios with a brand new CD, and one half of the band joins me live in WFDD's Studio A for a rare up-close and unplugged preview. Here's a sneak peek with a cut off the new CD titled Paula, Come On. Out of my mind over you. I guess it's true what they say about waiting too long, 'cause now I'm sick, heartbroken, writing songs about you. About you. Saying hello, but your reaction makes me wonder. Went out of your way just to make me feel like I did something wrong. Well, I get it, it's over. Yeah, I'm sure that's what you want. Now all confusion is gone, but I still find that you got someone new. I'm out of my mind over you. I guess it's true what they say about waiting. You. Welcome back to Triad Arts Weekend. I'm David Ford. So, are you ready to rock? Janice 414 is on the verge of releasing their very first album, and they want you to come celebrate. The self-titled Janice 414, recorded, mixed, and produced by Mitch Easter at Fidelatorium Studios, is full of sweaty, energetic rock and roll with just a pinch of punk. And you'll hear plenty of 90s influence too, but delve just a little beneath the surface and you'll find a whole host of musical references hiding amongst the interconnected storylines. As lead singer, guitarist, and songwriter Chad Barnard tells it, those stories are deeply personal, collected over many years, and they're keeping it real for Janice 414 fans. They're set to catchy melodies, too, that'll have you humming. Coming up Friday, May 11th, those tunes will be ringing through the Flatiron in Greensboro during the band's CD release party, beginning at 10 o'clock with special guests Bell Indica. In the meantime, here's my interview with Chad and guitarist, keyboardist, and background vocalist Shane Maugham.
Every hesitation seems like an act of war.
He writes pop songs, and you add pop plus metal equals punk. There's something about, because our drummer plays in metal bands, he has that natural inclination to push things and drive a little more, and I think that Chad's poppy melodies combined with our drummer's just edge, and I've just kind of put my guitar to fit right in the middle of those two, and it has that kind of punk aspect to it. I mean, I've told people, we never thought he would turn to a punk band, but all of a sudden we listen to our songs, and they're all 2.5 minutes long, and a lot of just driving punky feel to it. And it's just the result of the four of us putting our stuff together. Our musical backgrounds all collide and have this kind of faux punk.
It's neat when you get that faux punk. Now, there's a new band or a tune, faux punk. I'm going to write that one down. But it's neat when it's organic like that because it's your sound. I mean, it's just Janice 414. You can call it whatever you want, but it's a neat mix.
Yeah, I appreciate that. There's always people always come up to us with references, and I'm like, I don't get the reference they make, but, I mean, that's cool.
1, 2, 3, 4!
But it seems like a thread or something that's important to you, Chad, is just raw, real.
Yeah, I mean, I'm totally of the school. I mean, the literature I go to, the songs I go to, I mean, you know, like, I mean, it's sort of cliche to say the Beats these days because everybody uses them. But especially Kerouac and especially Thomas Wolfe. I mean, just that whole thing that everybody on the street has their story they're telling. And to me, I just really get into our life and stuff that's happened to us, and especially to me, since I'm writing the lyrics, and every song has an insane just amount of personal references that, depending on which of my friends you are, you'll get different in-jokes that other people would never get.
Well, then you take real and you add, I do everything musically, especially by just feeling. We had a discussion in practice a couple weeks ago about how I never play the same thing twice for a lot of our songs. It's because I don't feel it that way the same way every time. So you take his reel and my reel, which are, you know, he's a very consistent guitar player. He likes the rhythm, and he plays that rhythm. And, you know, it's real to him, but for me, real is what I feel at the moment. So my feeling and his reality kind of has this, it melds into, I mean, I think it's how we think music. It's just what it's supposed to be like. You know, this is whatever happens at that moment.
It's a nice balance because you do need both. The solidity, so I'm on that journey with you, but then you throw off a little detour or something that's spontaneous and improvisational. It really does give that Jimi Hendrix rawness that I really like. I get both in what I'm hearing in a lot of these tunes.
But his consistency is no less real than my inconsistency. As far as, I mean, that's who he is. He's a very scheduled person by nature, and I'm an anti-schedule completely. And it's funny how it comes through in our music.
It was so funny because when we were recording, and I was knocking off a lot of the acoustic tracks because I play acoustic, even though we play loud, fast music. I'm playing acoustic the whole time, and I play it real percussive and real rhythmic because most bands, like the drummer, were focusing on the bass player, but in our band, the drummer focuses a lot with me because I'm doing a lot of accents that it only feels right if he kicks in the same time with me. And it was funny. Mitch was like, "You know, there's a skill there. You're doing something I've never seen. I don't know why you would choose to play like that, but it's pretty impressive." And the reason I had was because for 10, 12, 13 years, I wasn't playing with anybody. So I was just in my room by myself on acoustic guitar playing songs, and I had to be my drummer. I had to be the different stuff. That's how my style evolved.
And I dated one of them at an IQ of 3. Well, I'm glad you mentioned Mitch. What do you pick up from a guy like that in terms of, I mean, he produced some of your idols. I mean, we're talking about REM was definitely an influence. And
Pavement,
another one. What are some of your takeaways from that working with Mitch?
He just has a huge knowledge. I mean, Yeah, we could have done this album and tried to self-record it, and it would have, I think the songs would have carried, but adding a producer and someone especially as knowledgeable as him, it just, like on Unspoken, it's the middle of our album, it's the slow song on our album. He was like, oh, you know what you need on this? You need this Echoplex.
Oh, yeah, the echo.
You need to take this Wurlitzer, which is a, you know, an organ-based instrument. We need to hook it through an Echoplex and then run it through an old 40s speaker that people used to have in their families when they listened to the radio.
Oh, yeah.
And we'll mic that.
Actually, it was a Watkins copycat for you nerds.
Oh, okay. And so it was just, we would have never thought of that. And the effect that it gave it to the song, it took the song to a whole other place it would never have went.
She called it quits. I said that's it. Threw each other off.
And there's also good times where he comes in and says, you really don't want to do that. And we were at a comfortable place where he could tell us that, because we were like, you know, you'd be totally open. If something's not working, you tell us. And it's just something, because structurally you just don't want to. And there were sometimes I was singing, he goes, I don't think, because I'm not a trained singer by any stretch. And he's like, I don't think you want the note you're trying to go for. And I'd never thought of it that way. And Shane was always like, I always thought you couldn't hit it. And I was like, no, I didn't understand which note I was really supposed to hit.
And plus, he has that ear. I always joke, you have it audioizing, the audio version visualizing. Like, you hear things before you hear it, then you make it happen. And that's how I do most everything. Anything I play, a lot of times I'll hear it first and just try to play what I hear. And he had that same thing, except for it was not just in playing or what we should do. It was like, okay, this is obviously the Hammond through the Leslie, because that's what fits. And I've never touched a Hammond or seen a Leslie, but he had them both and goes and pulls it out and says, okay, let's go. Let's do it here. And like the Watkins copycat, we used a different point. And then just as far as the full album, we actually let Mitch, we played a couple extra songs. We got down to one song left. We had one spot. We had three songs. So we were like, Mitch, what do you think? We want your opinion, because we know you know what you're doing better than any of us. And the one he picked is one of my favorite tracks on the album. It's The Gun. And that was probably not going to be on there.
It's really just a straight, like, blues song. It's probably one of the most straight-ahead songs we have. And he took it to a whole different other place, like an early Meat Puppets, just like Sonic Canyon type thing. And we would have never thought of that.
I think of more as late Hendrix.
Yeah, it's him. We have different references.
Great. Well, now just talking about music makes you want to dig in and hear some.
Okay, great.
You all were kind enough to bring your guitars, depending on your point of view, to Studio A.
This is actually kind of fun. When I listened to the CD, you know, like 10 minutes ago, you guys walk in the room, I have all these fresh ideas, and I'm sure they're all wrong, but the title of the album is Janus 414?
It's self-titled, yeah.
In some senses, it struck me as kind of like, was it art rock? The Yes albums, kind of a journey, you know, from start to finish.
Okay.
Looking back on a time period in your life, but a lot of connectivity in the tunes.
Yeah. There's a lot of characters that show. Like, even from the last LP, there's still some of those characters that show up in these songs. A lot of the times, something will strike me, or I'll get a memory from 10 years ago or 15, or maybe something happened yesterday. And I'll say, okay, well, it's one of the ones that happened a long time ago. I'll be like, what was I feeling at that moment? You know, how was I feeling then? And then usually something will come up and make
a
song.
So you're looking back on what chunk of your life? You all are 30-somethings now. Are you looking back primarily at your
There's late? A lot of 20 to 24-year-old years there, just because you make a lot of mistakes and do a lot of stupid stuff. And so it's looking back at that. A lot of times, you know, there'll be like somebody I'm accusing or sort of reprimanding in the songs, and people are like, oh, who are you mad at? I was like, I'm talking to myself sometimes. A lot of the times about that kind of stuff. So,
but at least a third of the album, if not more, is based on stuff within the last 2 years.
That's true. These songs, yeah.
Well, regardless, you've got the sameness is it's reflection that seems real. And I appreciate that as a listener. Second Chances is one of those tunes. And tell me about the backstory on that one.
Second Chances is really, I talk about how I have this plan for all this. And Second Chances is sort of different than a lot of the stuff on the album. Me and my wife watched Crazy Heart, that Jeff Bridges film about country music. And then after it, I just had this overall feeling. And, you know, I was just thinking, everybody writes love songs for, you know, when you're just in love or you're a teen or you're in your 20s and maybe you found the first love of your life and stuff. And I was like, nobody writes it for, like, you know, the middle-aged, twice-divorced person that just, you know, don't want to spend the rest of their life alone. And I was like, they need a song too. Everybody needs love. So that's where it started in my head. Of course, there's stuff that has to do with me and different old relationships and stuff in the song, but the main impetus for the song was that.
An ode to the middle-aged twice divorced. I love that. And there are lots of listeners who could really cheer for a song
like
this.
Yeah,
yeah. Well, let's hear a cut, as long as you all are here in Studio A.
Okay.
That's your second chances.
Started, nothing said, but I don't want to wait no more. Smoldered fingers, that's what you get. I'm holding on to love too long. So I got no time for regrets and second chances. I'll spend, but I want you. Things keep changing, I know it's hard, feeling so out of control. Years have shown us we're not that smart, but I don't wanna be alone. So I got no time for regrets and second chances. I'll spend, but I want you. Chances are this could all go wrong. You'll hate me and I'll hate you. And if it does, I think we'll both agree. I'll find someone new. You'll find someone too. I've blown a few, ending face down on the floor. We're starting over, that's nothing new. We'll take it as it comes from now on. So I got no time for regrets and second chances. I spent, but I want you.
Really neat to get a chance to hear you guys doing this on acoustic. It's a different feel, but you have the drive going on. We just heard Chad Barnard vocals and guitar, and Shane Mock guitar and vocals and synth on the CD.
Yes.
Your voices pair up real nice together in the back. You've just got that same timbre. Doing some nice backup vocals. I was struck by the shift in the falsetto section in the middle on the LP. It's this kind of off-in-the-distance radio or TV sound, mm-hmm. which I'm sure Mitch had some role in.
Yeah.
Perfectly effective. But it tuned me into kind of the little Beatles influence in a sense of that segment. I'm thinking Eleanor Rigby and loneliness and all that kind of stuff. But it really captures the spirit of it.
Oh, that's great, because, I mean, Beatles, John Lennon especially, but the Beatles have their fingerprints all over our stuff. I mean, a lot of people's stuff. I mean, you know?
Who they do, they don't have. But I like the variety there.
Mitch, it was fun being in the studio with radio sounds. And for that synth part that's on the album, I couldn't find the tone I wanted on my synth and couldn't think of something. So finally I pulled out my iPod Touch and have a synth app. And so had Mitch in his, you know, multi-million dollar studio and pull out an iPod Touch and play a free app to get the synth sound on the album. And
did it one take, and Mitch was like, well, you can't do better than that. That's it.
Nice.
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah, there's that is kind of a signature of Janis 414, the Shane Touch. There are lots of them.
He makes the song so much better.
Yeah. I call it ear candy.
Yeah.
You guys keep the drive going with the guitars. That's a neat riff. How'd you stumble on that one? That da-da-da-da-da-da?
Honestly, it's one of those things where it just comes to you. You're sitting there. I don't know how other musicians work. I mean, they all work different ways. But I'll just usually sit at my downstairs. I have like a little office or place where I can go by myself. And it's essential when you have like three kids. So all my CDs and I got collages of like all my artists that I love up on the walls and stuff. And I'll just sit there and just strum away. And then sometimes something will come. You're just like, oh, I like that.
It's an interesting juxtaposition because you got, and really you're talking about, and one of the lines in there, feeling so out of control. And then you got this, at the same time, this driving, dun, 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 dun. It's like, let's go sort of feel to it.
Yeah, the whole song is basically saying, hey, we've made some mistakes in the past. You know, our track record's not that good, but forget that. Right now, this feels great, and let's run with it. Let's just embrace it.
Yeah. I want to dive in with another tune. Can you play something else?
Yeah.
Yeah, I really enjoyed Unspoken on a lot of levels. Want to dive into the writing process and writing and performing, that whole thing. It's a neat tune.
Unspoken.
Oh. Yeah,
whenever you're ready. Some things are better left unspoken, especially what I think about you. Beat down, bloody, bruised and broken, cut our ties, we're through. The girl I liked, having you around, having you to talk to, our voices without a sound. Convinced ourselves it's true, but being alone isn't much better. That's the best we can do. This girl I like, having you around, having you to talk to, voices without a sound. And I like having you around, having you to talk to. I wonder where you're off to now. She called it quits. I said that's it. We threw each other off the canyon, only to have us echo back again. I miss those lights, little 5 points on Friday nights, shows at the point and criminal records, waxing facts and jumping starters. Being apart's been so much better. We tried to deny it, but we knew. Brought out the worst in each other. I hope Chicago's good to you. This girl I liked, having you around, having you to talk to, our voices without a sound. And I liked having you around, having you to talk to. I wonder what you're up to now.
Unspoken. And we heard Chad Barnard, vocals and guitar, and Shane Mock, guitar. Neat tune. It makes me think of just the personal nature of the storytelling there. I guess it begins with the writing. Talk me through that, Chad. I'm assuming this is your tune.
Yeah.
Getting in touch with that from a writing perspective. When did you feel like, oh, this is a theme I'm going to explore, and how did it come about?
Well, I have these tapes, these little microtapes.
Oh, like a dictaphone sort of thing?
Uh-huh. And so for the last 15 years, anytime I have an idea, I'll record it and say, okay, I'll work on that later. And so I've got 10 or 12 tapes full of just different ideas. And I'll go back from time to time and listen to them. And this was one of the ones that started, the idea of the song is probably 12 to 13 years old. Huh. So it was definitely going on at the moment when I started the song.
You heard it, and then after 12 years, it had new resonance for some reason?
Yes, a lot of these songs. Because I was such a mad tear, and I wasn't really recording with anybody, so I had nobody pushing me, hey, finish these songs. I'll just record all these ideas. And so now that we're in a band and recording songs, I'll go through and listen. And we found a lot of songs that way through, like, oh, man, we should make this a song. And so this one's about Atlanta when I went to school there and Little Five Points, the area, and all the punk club, The Point, which was there. It's not there anymore. Criminal Records, which is like my favorite record shop. It was just about that whole era of I would look forward to every weekend getting to go to Little Five Points. Because I'm from a small town, Mount Airy, and down there was just, you know, before the internet, if I wanted something, I had to find it in a mail order catalog and order it and wait 6 to 8 weeks for the music to get here, and I might get it, I might not like it. Down there, anything you wanted, you could get it right then. And so it was just the feel of going and discovering new music every weekend and coming home with stuff, and also the relationship I had there. And it was just we were just really bad to each other and really shouldn't have been with each other, but there was nobody else at that moment, so we sort of clung to each other. Because we were both from Mount Airy and sort of fishes out of water. And so it was just sort of saying, hey, we had a great time, but we're so much better off that we're not together anymore.
that feeling of feeling trapped, that's something a lot of people can relate to.
Hopefully. I mean, that's the only way I can feel it. If I don't have a personal connection, I can't really feel it. That's why all the songs we do, it's really personal, but I hope I tell it in a way that it's the universality or whatever the 50 Cent word is, that comes across where other people can understand what I'm trying to get across and feel it as well.
And Shane, how about you in terms of the performing aspect of these tunes and what you bring to it? Where are you pulling from, you know, when you're performing, and what's it like, you know, being in a room of group of folks you may not have even met before?
That's my favorite kind of people, people I haven't met before. I love to try to make that connection with them. When you have an audience member or two in front of you, it's nice to be out there and make that eye contact with people and say, let's see what you like. And that's kind of what I was talking about, the feeling of music and not knowing. I mean, I may play something completely different in concert that I've never practiced before because that person looked like they might want to hear that to me. So I'm playing the music, but they're just as much a part of it as we are. They're just not the ones making the noise, or hopefully, and sometimes they're clapping along or singing along with us. But I may try something just based on somebody's reaction to one thing. It gives me something to do later in the show, that whether I've done it before or not. But I love when Chad brings a song in, because that's like I learned a long time ago, I'm not a songwriter. It's not my skill. I'm not good at it. And I have a lot of trouble if I ever try to sit down and write a song from scratch. But if he has an idea, that's like the perfect thing for me. I'm almost disappointed when he comes in and is like, I got this song completely finished. I'm like, no, it can't be finished. Let me help finish it. Because finishing is my favorite part, is taking a song and saying, okay, here's what we got. Now let's make it sound like this. Or why don't we try this here or do this?
You guys are like the ultimate collaborators. I mean, it seems like that's who you want in your camp.
We work very well together. And then Brad and Chris add so much in what they do.
And we're talking about Brad Nichols, the bass player, and Chris Charter on drums. Maybe a tune to wrap up that kind of calls on both of those strengths. Maybe a tune that came in half-baked, and then between the two of you, you managed to flesh out in a way that made it to the album.
I think we need to do the one foot, two foot. That's perfect what he just said. It's not on the album, but it's a new one.
Yeah. That's a favorite song to play, I guess.
You got a new one? Tell me about it.
Well, I've been told by other radio broadcasters that my literary choice wasn't so great, but I like him fine. Franzen, he has this book called Freedom. A majority of the song is based on the main female character in that story, but of course, it's filtered through my lens, and a lot of the stuff is basically me talking to myself, saying, hey, you need to recognize you have this in you, and it might be a fault, and you might need to change it before it's too late. But it's called One Pill, Two Pill. And just for you, the F word in this song is Faulkner. People sometimes get that misconstrued, but it's Faulkner.
Everyone wonders. Faulkner's women.
So we're going to try. This is one I had, and I wanted like a football, like rugby-style chant where we're all singing all the verses and everything all together. And I just thought it would make a great effect. And Shane was like, no, we don't need to do that. We need to do something different. And he came up with this hand clapping thing that just really sets the tone, and it makes it so much different than the rest of our songs. So this is a newer one called One Pill, Two Pill. Almost lost control. She's got a lot of problems. 40's down, 27 to go. She's got herself a book to write down all her secrets. Come on. She's
settled with a man, in touch with his feelings. Like Faulkner's women, all he does is endure. He always understands. It gets pretty annoying. Come on. Well, come on. Well, come on. It takes one pill, she's feeling fine. Ow! It takes two pills to get through the night. Ow! Understands the morning after breakdown, when taillights fade, everything seems so clear. A bridges to the past, a baptizing fire. Come on, becoming what you hate. Well, you're just getting older. Cry drunken tears to the person you were, or sacrifice your kids and relive adolescence. Come on, come on, come on. Takes one pill, she's feeling fine. Ow! It takes two pills to get through the night. Ow! Ba da 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 da. Ba da 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 da. Ba da 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 da. Ba da da da. Takes a lot to sink in. Freedom's price is the expense of your soul. Lose to get ahead, lucky to maintain it. Come on, 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 come on.
That was great. That was One Pill, Two Pill. We heard Chad Barnard, vocals and guitar, Shane Mock, guitar, vocals. Can we expect that on the next album?
Yes.
Definitely.
I'd lead it off with that one.
Yeah.
That sounds
That's
great.
That's one of our favorites right now.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for stopping by, guys. I really appreciate it.
Thank you.
Thank you.
My thanks to Janice 414's Chad Barnard and Shane Mock. Their new self-titled CD, Janice 414, comes out today, and you can help celebrate at their CD release party beginning at 10 o'clock tonight at the Flatiron in Greensboro. You'll find links to more information on our website, wfdd.org/triadarts. Well, that's all for today's show. Live from Studio A was recorded by WFDD's audio engineer extraordinaire, Eddie Garcia. You'll find podcasts, archived episodes, and links to all of the arts events we cover today on our website. Again, that's wfdd.org/triadarts. I'm David Ford. Thanks to all the mothers out there. Enjoy your special day, and thanks for listening to Triad Arts Weekend.